Everybody,
it's so great to be back at PI, and thank you so much, Juan, for organizing this talk for me. So I'm going to tell you about possible generalizations of Lenzi Turing spacetimes. And so these are spacetimes describing basically gravitational field outside of slowly rotating bodies. And interestingly, so of course everybody now knows the Kerr geometry describing a rotating black hole. But it took almost 50 years to discover that solution. But for slowly rotating ones, you could actually, people could discover that in 3 years after the Einstein equations were published. So this is much younger solution, which really goes back to the early days of general relativity. So here's the plan of the talk. I will first introduce what these Lenzi Turing spacetimes are. And then I will tell you how to generalize them. And I will also tell you why we are really so even today interested in these LT spacetimes. And the main reason is that basically this is precisely what you get if you apply this famous or infamous Neumann-Jannich formal trick, which was actually used to generate Kerr-Newman geometry in the past. And then I will tell you how to, you know, how these metrics are applicable or not in theories beyond Einstein's gravity, and in theories with matter, and in theories in higher dimensions, and so on. And finally, I will talk about some possible upgrade of this solution, and you know, its amazing geometrical properties. So my talk is based on these three papers over here. So you see Finn Gray, who is a student, and he's over there. So he has participated in two of these works. But everything basically began with this paper over here by Matt Visser, and who noticed that if you modify these Lenzi Turing spacetimes in a certain way, you get very nice geometrical properties. Namely, you get killing tensors, but you also get manifest regularity on the horizon, and you get very nice coordinates, which actually the metric can be written on. So anyway, so this is what it's based on. And I will take this off because I cannot speak. So is that okay? Is everybody? Okay, great. So here we go. So this is the famous Lenzi Turing spacetime as of 1918. So you see that it looks like Schwarzschild geometry. It's this metric function f, 1 minus 2m over r. But the only departure from Schwarzschild geometry is this dt d phi cross term over here, which precisely corresponds to the slow rotation of a rotating body. So, you know, we were describing, you know, the far away space-time outside of the rotating body. Okay, so interestingly, this is only an approximate solution of vacuum Einstein equations. So it is varied to the linear order in rotation parameter A here. And it's precisely what you would get if you actually expand Kerr to the linear order in A. Once you, you know, go to higher orders, of course, Kerr is much more complicated. But what is amazing about the spacetime already is that it encodes, you know, so-called gravitomagnetic effects. And so that's basically like the first prediction when you go beyond Einstein theory, beyond Newton's theory, then the next step is basically that you get these gravitomagnetic effects. So what are gravitomagnetic effects of frame dragging? It's a general relativistic effect due to the motion and in particular rotation of matter, but also of gravitational waves. And it's, you know, analogous to electromagnetic induction. So we already know from the first course in general relativity that already at the field approximation, once your team nu includes not only the energy density, but also the energy current, then you start producing some interesting phenomena. And so these can be described by the vector potential which you form out of these, you know, of diagonal components of the metric. And then interestingly, your Einstein equations basically rewrite at, you know, at that linearized level as the Maxwell equations for the vector potential A mu, including the Lorentz gauge condition, which is your harmonic gauge condition in GR, right? But also, if you look at the geodesic equations and expand them to the linear order in velocity, then you get basically like a Lorentz force law, except there is this magical minus 4, which is different from Lorentz force. So anyway, so this is already at the linearized level. And of course, everything here survives at the nonlinear level as well, but it just gets more complicated, right? But you get basically, so Einstein theory definitely knows about electromagnetism. Okay, so here is the first notice of this phenomenon. And as I said, it goes to 1918. So once you have the sphere which slowly rotates, so it's similar to a charge sphere, and which would produce the magnetic field. So in this case, you produce a gravitomagnetic field, Vg, which looks like this. So now if you start, if you send a particle in, let's say radially, and if you had a charge in magnetic field, it would experience this Lorentz force. And so as a result, actually, it starts rotating with the sphere. And so here's the Coriolis type force, which you get, you know, by this, you know, V cross B term, as you know it. Okay, and so as we'll notice in this paper in 1918. So similarly, you would get frame dragging inside this here. So actually, the inside of the hollow shell or whatever would also rotate with respect to distant stars and so on. Interestingly, this is not only due to the matter, but if you have, let's say, you know, rotating gravitational waves, then they would also cause inertial frame dragging, and these two references over here. So you have like a rotating gravitational wave coming from infinity, and interestingly enough, you know, inside there will be a frame dragging, and things will start rotating with respect to distant stars. So it's not only, you know, property of the matter, but it's also property of the gravitational waves. Of course, we all know the most famous example of frame dragging is the extremal frame dragging, which happens close to Kerr black hole, and we know there is an ergosphere, which actually where, you know, nothing can stay still with respect to the black hole, and everything has to co-rotate with that. Now, there's very many applications of this frame dragging in astrophysical settings, and let me just name one. So there's this famous Bardeen-Petersen effect. And because of this Lorentz force, what really actually happens is that if you have accreting matter onto a black hole, then eventually the accretion disk will be actually perpendicular to the axis of rotation due to this Lorentz force. Okay, and so that's one astrophysical application. So now, has this been measured? Yes, it has, but surprisingly only very recently, although the experiment almost lasted 50 years or something like that. So people started, you know, thinking about this already in the 60s and 70s and whatever. But then it took 50 years to really measure this. And it's the gravity probe experiment. So what people did is that they launched a satellite, and on that satellite they put a gyroscope. And so now the satellite actually goes above the North Pole on a circular trajectory. And then you have basically two effects which are happening with the spin of the gyroscope. So first, there's like a normal geodesic effect if there were no rotation. So if you just consider perfect Schwarzschild, you would have geodesic effect, you know, of twisting the spin of there. But also you have the rotation. So the Earth rotates like that. And of course, that causes this other effect, which is this frame dragging effect. And you can think about it like, you know, if I'm close to Earth. So you can think about like the vector, which has like two points. One is closer to the Earth, and one is more distant. If you are closer to the Earth, of course, the frame dragging is stronger. And so you rotate faster. If you are further from the Earth, then it's actually smaller, the effect. And so that's why there is this twist, like, so opposite to the rotation. So if the Earth rotates like that, you will have twisting like that of the spin. So anyway, so let me also notice that, of course, this frame dragging effect is much, much smaller than the geodesic effect. And it's about, you know, 200 times or something. Questions so far? If not, so okay, let's go to how we generalize these metrics here. But before we do that, let me provide some motivation why we are really even nowadays interested in these metrics. And there's this amazing Neumann-Jänisch trick, which is basically an algorithm on how to generate rotating solutions from the static ones by something very weird, which is a complex coordinate transformation. And so I will give you just one prescription how to do this. There's really a recipe, and there's like 20 different recipes how to do that. But in the end, you end up with the same metric, so it doesn't really matter which recipe you use. Each recipe has some problems, which are swept under the carpet. But anyway, so let me just present one of the recipes. And what is really important is the resulting metric, because all recipes agree on that resultant metric. So we start with the spherically symmetric spacetime, static one, and we go to the ingoing Finkelstein coordinates like that. We want to preserve the regularity on the horizon, so why not? Or you can alternatively do it in terms of the null frame. So here's the null frame associated with this metric over here. All right, so now you perform this complex coordinate transformation. So you go from u to u minus ia, where a is your new parameter describing rotation, cosine theta, and similarly for r. But at the same time, you change your metric functions, f and g, which were functions of r only before, now to functions of r, a, and theta to be determined. Okay. And so similarly, what happens with the null tetrad is this thing over here. So the last step is basically, let's return back to the standard Boyle-Lindquist coordinates. So here's your transformation. Again, there are some functions, lambda and chi, which are to be determined. And the condition which determines everything is basically that you require that the metric remains diagonal in the Boyle-Lindquist coordinates, except the GT phi component. Okay, and so this requirement actually miraculously fixes everything what you see over here. And you end up with this metric over here. So now if you are familiar with the Kerr metric, this is basically Kerr metric, or Kerr-Newman metric, as written over here, where your metric function delta, which determines your horizon and stuff like that, is actually determined by the solution which you started with, the static solution f.
Okay? So is it natural expect from this construction that this metric is a solution of the Einstein
equation? I wouldn't say it's natural. because you are doing some weird thing, right? You are doing a complex coordinate transformation. Then in the end, you are sort of, taking, you have to kill the imaginary part somehow and stuff like that. So that's, this selection mechanism is really, you are taking the GT phi thing here and so on. As the only non-diagonal component, and so I wouldn't say it's obvious that you really preserve the fact that if you start with a solution, you end up with a solution again. So why this is really, of course, why this is really famous and interesting is that because this is how the Kerr-Newman solution was generated, right? And so people really use it to generate a new solution, and since then people keep hoping that they can generate more. But as I will show you, actually, this is not entirely true. Okay. So now, what is important for us is that I will again, restrict myself to this slow rotation. So I will do the linear in A expansion of this, and if you do that, you end up with this metric over here. Okay, which is precisely the Lenz-Turing spacetime as we saw it before. Yes.
This check—it's not obvious that it generates a solution.
It's not.
But does it generate?
Well, it did in the past, and then,
Is there a theorem or
No, there's no theorem. There's no theorem. It generates solutions. But if you actually look at the archive carefully, at least once a week, you will find a paper there, like, we have generated a new solution by using this for this theory. Okay. And then next week, there's a different solution for a different theory, right? And so on. So people keep, writing papers on this, and they keep writing, I have generated a new solution for this interesting theory by applying precisely this mechanism. Okay, so people hope that this works, right? Okay, very good. So this is the standard LT spacetime, especially if you want vacuum Einstein gravity, then this will be a solution as we saw it to the linear order in rotation parameter. So now this is precisely my question. So how generic is this ansatz? And can we apply it to really generate new solutions in, let's say, modified gravity theories and so on? Can we generate some non-vacuum solutions? And in particular, can we always use, this Newman-Janisch trick to generate new rotating solutions? Yes? I'll be focusing on the slow rotation. But of course, this is precisely what this is the full metric which you get, right? Yeah. But if it doesn't already work at the linear level, then this will be wrong as well, right? Yeah. So that's the idea. All right, so this is what we have done. So we've looked at you know, beyond Einstein gravity by considering higher curvature corrections. And so this is your Lagrangian. So you have, you know, zero order in Riemann. Then you have linear, quadratic, cubic, and quartic. And then you have corresponding coupling constants, which you know, stand over here. So just to give you an idea, so for example, at the quadratic order, you have the following three invariants. At the cubic order, you have the following eight invariants, which you can, you know, construct out of the Riemann tensor. I'm not considering its dual. And I don't dare to write the fourth order over here. So anyway, so once you have this Lagrangian, you can write down the equations of motion, which are very neatly written in this way, epsilon AB equals to zero. And epsilon depends on this tensor P, which is just a derivative of L with respect to the Riemann. And of course, you know, this would be quite complicated. So if you want to spell it down for, you know, all, for the whole theory, that will take you two pages or something like that. So anyway, so now in order to see what's happening, let us generalize our answers a little bit. So we are putting the n over here, just why not? Let's put a Laplace function there. And then we are taking a general function h here. So what we have seen for the standard Lenzi Turing space times is that h was equal to f minus 1 and n was equal to 1. So we will impose that condition and we'll be asking, are there, you know, any solutions to the theory which we are considering? So now, imposing n equal to 1 has actually nothing to do with rotation. Okay, so you can show that it's completely independent of the rotation parameter A. And so basically, imposing n equal to 1, you are asking, can I find static spherically symmetric solutions which have n equal to 1? And so interestingly, the corresponding theories were already found and are characterized. They are called generalized quasi-topological gravities. I will tell you what they are in a moment. So for example, if you just restrict to the quadratic order, then requiring the spherically symmetric solution has n equal to 1, so it's characterized by only single metric function f, that actually restricts that all three, so there's three invariants at the quadratic order, and you have three coupling constants, alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3. And so the requirement n equals to 1 fixes all of them in terms of one parameter alpha. So in other words, you actually discover that n equal to 1 requirement leads you to the Gauss-Bonnet gravity. Right? Of course, if you are in four dimensions, this is topological, and you are back to Einstein. Right? Okay, so what are these generalized quasi-topological gravities? Basically, precisely by definition, they are those which whole spherical symmetric solution has n equal to 1. And, you know, it started with papers by Rob Myers and then, you know, Bueno and Cano, and then we finally wrote the answer for cubic things, and there's also, you know, what happens at the quadratic order. So basically what happens is that, you know, you start with a theory which in principle, let's say, has 3 plus 8 plus 25 parameters, coupling constants, and the requirement that n equal to 1 actually reduces these, you know, parameters to 19 at the cubic order. Okay, it reduces to 1 at the quadratic order. It reduces to Gauss-Bonnet gravity. For cubic one, it reduces to 4, and then for quartic one gives you that. All right. So now here we go with the theorem. So the statement is that if I impose n equal to 1, and if I impose h equal to f minus 1 as we know it, which is what, you know, what is predicted by Neumann-Janisch, then actually you find that in d equal to 4, there is no any other theory which would work. Okay? So the Einstein gravity in four dimensions is the only one where you can do that. It's the only theory where you can hope that you can generate, you know, new solutions by Neumann-Janisch trick. Okay? So this is, you know, apparently interesting result because it kills half of the papers appearing on the archive, right? Because people always, you know, modify gravity and they say, I've generated a new solution of this gravity by Neumann-Janisch trick. Well, it's apparently shown that here that it already breaks at the linear order in A.
So are you saying that
Well, the way I presented it, it was for n equal to 1. So maybe there are some, you know, weird generalizations which would predict not n equal to 1, but I haven't seen those. So all those which appear on the archive have n equal to 1.
But
Don't they check that their solutions are in fact solutions? Because that would tell.
Well, that's typically, well, the clever people do it, right? So they say, well, let's try if this works. And then they, you know, do it, they find the metric, they conclude, well, we have checked the equations and it doesn't work, right? So that's one paper, how you can write one paper. Less clever people, they don't check, right? And they claim we have a new solution, right? Or they say, well, we have a solution which approximately will be the right solution. And yeah, it's very weird. So, you know, as a corollary, Newman-Yannis trick cannot be used to generate rotating solutions in other than Einstein gravity in four dimensions. So the proof is annoying. I will not annoy you with that. It's just, you know, you can look at asymptotically at the solutions and you can, you know, impose the requirements and it kills all the coupling constants. And it's done. Interestingly, this is no longer true in five dimensions. And in five dimensions, you could potentially generate some new solutions, at least at the linear order in A, for modified gravity theories. Okay, and so you can see some restrictions in our paper if you are interested. Okay, so very good. So if you are in four dimensions, it's only Einstein gravity. So what about putting some matter there, right? Can we include some matter? So for Maxwell ADS case, yes, we can. So we know Newman ADS still works, can be generated by Newman-Yannis trick. So this is your solution, Newman ADS. And so that works. However, if you go to some, you know, more complicated theory, including a dilaton or whatever, then it no longer works. So for Kersen, you cannot generate it by Newman-Yannis or whatever here. So now people also interested in nonlinear electrodynamics. I have been interested in this for 20 years. So basically, it's like a nonlinear generalization of Maxwell theory. So instead of considering the Lagrangian, which would be just S, invariant S, F mu nu, F mu nu, you suddenly consider some general function of S and P, where P is the other invariant over here, right? And so then you have the generalized Maxwell equations, and you can write down the generalized Einstein equations, and so on. Okay, so the most famous example here would be the Bonenfeld theory, which is very, you know, interesting from the string theory perspective, and so on. Okay, very good. So now, in this class of generalized theories, you can still show that n is equal to 1, and that has actually been shown by Jacobson many years ago. But the statement is that, again, you know, if you open the archive almost every week, you see, well, there is new solutions, rotating solutions to these theories. And you can split them into three categories. So obviously wrong solutions, which obviously do not satisfy, you know, equations. People don't bother to check the equations. Then you have the Newman-Yannis generating metrics. And of course, well, we shall see what happens. And then other solutions, people, for example, claim that they found the rotating solution. What they really found was a Taub-Knot solution or something like that. So not really an asymptotically flat rotating solution, which you would like. So, you know, we restricted just for simplicity on a function of one invariant of S, and for, let's say, considered magnetically charged solutions, the result is the same for electrically charged solutions and for some generalized theories as well. But anyway, so the theorem is the following. If you want H equal to F minus 1, then this will be inconsistent with any nonlinear electrodynamics except Maxwell's theory. So again, you cannot use Newman-Yannis formalism or trick to generate anything except in the Maxwell case. It seems like Newman and Yannis were really, really lucky that they considered, you know, Maxwell case and Einstein gravity, right? If they considered anything else, it wouldn't work. Okay. So very good. So now we can play the same game in higher dimensions. So now I include more rotation parameters. You saw these AIs over here. Then you have the azimuthal coordinates mu I, and you have approximately, so m here is something like number of dimensions divided by 2. So you have, you know, these, so mu I's are basically like sines and cosines of theta and so on. So this condition is a generalization of sine squared theta plus cosine squared theta equals to 1. So this is like a higher dimensional generalization of these azimuthal angles. It should be sine, yeah, of course, thank you. Oh, very, very good, Nash. Okay, so that's the generalization. And so we are putting here, you know, these new metric functions over there. But then you would be imposing again that all of them are equal to f minus 1, which would be precisely like Lenz-Etting form in higher dimensions. So interestingly, if you look at, you know, some theories, for example, it works in the Einstein-Maxwell ADS case. So really, you know, for this kind of theory, you can find a solution in this form where all hi are equal to f minus 1, as written over here. And so everything is characterized in terms of the static solution. But what is also interesting is that it only works at the linear order in rotation parameter A. Okay, so nobody knows how to actually write down analytically solutions of an Einstein-Maxwell theory in higher dimensions, rotating ones. Right, so this is only true at the linear order in A. Right, and so, but at least, you know, it gives you some idea that maybe the Neumannianish, if you modify it somehow, it could work in higher dimensions. Even more interestingly, it works for some theories beyond Einstein. So it, for example, works for Lovelock gravities. So Lovelock gravity is a nice theory which in all dimensions leads to, is the most general theory which leads to second order equations of motion. So these are Euler densities, that's your Lagrangian over here. And this is how you determine the metric function f. But surprisingly, you can construct, you know, multiply spinning, slowly rotating black holes in Lovelock gravity in all dimensions, like that. Does not work for minimal gauge supergravity. And the reason is very interesting. If you look at what is HA and HB, you have two rotations in five dimensions. And so you have HA and HB. But you see that HA should typically depend only, well, it depends on the other parameter here. It depends on B. And HB depends on A. So there's this weird mixing between A and B, which we don't understand why it is there. It's a result of this, you know, Chern-Simons terms over here. But it's very, very weird that you know, it breaks down like that. Okay, questions so far? So we discussed, you know, the standard Lenz-Etting spacetimes. And now we do a small trick, which is insane, but also very useful at the same time. So this is your metric, which we were just discussing. I just changed H to P because of the paper. Notations are different in the various papers. So now what you do is that you complete the square between d phi and dt term. Okay. So basically, you go from here to there. Of course, what it amounts to is that you are including extra a square term. Okay. So this metric, in with respect to that metric, has an additional a square term. Okay, so very good. It will still be a linear solution of Einstein equations. So that, you know, including a square term does not help. But on the other hand, it has very many nice properties if you do that. So first of all, you know, the former metric here, if you just calculate the invariance on the horizon, then they will be fine at the linear order in A, but they will diverge at the quadratic order in A. This is no longer true here. Everything is nice and smooth. It even admits this, you know, very nice van Leeuwen-Gulstrand coordinates, which I will mention what they are to you in a minute. And, you know, that also shows that, you know, everything is manifestly regular on the horizon. Moreover, this metric does not have any nice symmetries. It's just, you know, time symmetric and phi symmetric. But this guy here suddenly pops out a new irreducible Killing tensor. I would say that this is the simplest spacetime you can think of if you want to talk about spacetimes with non-trivial Killing tensors. Okay, and this was discovered in this paper over here. So let me elaborate on these things. So first of all, what is this PG form over here? So that's our metric. And so then you go basically to a coordinate system associated with an infalling observer from rest at infinity. And so this would be the corresponding four velocity of that observer, and that suggests that you should be changing coordinates like that. So you are going from small t to capital T over here. So that's the resulting metric. And finally, you change the phi angle. So here, everything depends on R. So this is a legitimate coordinate transformation. So in the end, what you end up with is this form of the metric, which looks quite ugly for, you know, when you compare to that, but it has some nice properties. So first nice property is, well, if you look at that metric here, I can freely set f equal to 0, and nothing, there's no problem whatsoever. So this is manifestly regular through the horizon. Of course, it's associated with the infalling observer, who shouldn't see any problems on the horizon. On the other hand, if you set capital DT equal to 0, well, this term is gone, and that term is gone. And then if you look at the metric, and of course this is gone, then you see just flat 3D metric. Okay, so it's just the r square, d theta square, d phi square. So what does it mean is that the observer who is actually infalling, you know, like that, what they see all the time around themselves at t equal to constant, it's a flat 3D space. So if you are flowing through the horizon or if you are close to the singularity, it doesn't matter. You just see flat 3D space. It's a nice flat 3D slicing of your space-time. Okay, so that's you know what people really like about these coordinates. Very good. So now killing tensors. I still have some time. Hope. So I loved killing tensors. I spent all my life doing killing tensors. So what the killing tensors are? Let me just give you a brief introduction. So a killing tensor is a totally symmetric tensor. So it can have, you know, p indices, and it's completely symmetric in all the p indices, which obeys a generalization of the killing vector equation. Okay, you just take covariant derivative, symmetrize everything, and you get zero. So now, why these objects are interesting is because they generate constants, for example, of geodesic motion, which are higher order in particle momentum. Right? So if I have a particle with momentum p, and I sandwich the k with all the pieces, as many as I need, then I form a scalar, and that will be a constant of motion for your geodesic. Okay? So what does it mean is that this guy here will possum commute with the Hamiltonian of the free particle. Okay? So that's what they are useful for. Of course, they are useful also at the quantum level. Yeah, they are useful for scalar fields, for Dirac fields, and so on. But you know, at the simplest level, we just know, you know, that they are useful for particles. Okay? So let me introduce this another notion, is that you say that, you know, the killing tensor is boring and reducible if it can be decomposed into a product of some lower rank killing tensors. Okay? Why is boring? Because I can use these lower rank killing tensors and they give me the same information. So for example, if you take two killing vectors, symmetrize them, you form a rank 2 killing tensor, but it will be trivial. It just doesn't give you anything new. Right? They would say it's irreducible if this cannot be done. Okay. Last thing which we should know about killing tensors is that they form an amazing algebra. And this is with respect to symmetric SN brackets. I don't know how to pronounce these things. So anyway, so you have one killing tensor of rank P, another killing tensor of rank Q, okay? And then you end up with a bracket, which is, you know, this rank P plus Q minus 1. And so that is a new killing tensor, okay? So how is this constructed? It's very simple. It can be constructed through the Poisson brackets. So if I take the corresponding constant of motion for geodesics, so I will take the KP, sandwich it with many P's, with many particle momenta, I will get a KP, and the similarly KQ, and I just take the standard Poisson bracket of them, okay? So then that defines the SN bracket over here. Or more explicitly, you know, for if you take a vector, killing vector, and a rank 2 killing tensor, then it just reduces to the Lie derivative of the killing tensor. If you take two rank 2 killing tensors, you get a rank 3 killing tensor, which is written over here. All right, so killing tensors are nice. They form a nice algebra with respect to these SN brackets. Okay, so why we care about killing tensors? It's because there is many spacetimes, especially, you know, various theories and whatever, with, you know, these killing tensors. And these killing tensors are useful because you can integrate geodesics and you can do other things as well. So, for example, you have Kerr geometry in 4 dimensions, but also in all higher dimensions, we'll have lots of rank 2 killing tensors. Dubna space will have lots of killing tensors. Various supergravity solutions have lots of killing tensors. Interestingly, until very recently, there were not known any examples with higher rank than 2 killing tensors. Okay, so that's not entirely true. In 2011, we constructed some artificial spacetimes, which actually would have the, let's say, rank 3 killing tensor or whatever. And that was a crazy construction. We basically started with integrable models in 2 dimensions, which had, you know, some weird constants of motion, and we lifted them up by 2 dimensions to actually form a 4 dimensional space-time, some kind of, you know, wave, which would inherit the symmetry from 2 dimensions. But you know, this is not a question without interest, because, you know, people keep studying, like, are there space-time is higher rank killing tensors? In fact, you can see lots of papers written about Kerr geometry. We know that Kerr geometry has Carter's constant, this rank 2 killing tensor, right? But people keep writing papers, well, does it have 4th rank killing tensor? Does it have 5th rank killing tensor, right? Are there any extra symmetries to Kerr geometry which we don't know about? And typically papers go like that. So people say, well, I will study whether the 5th rank killing tensor is present in Kerr geometry. Okay, so then they write down the equations for the rank 5 killing tensor. The equations are horrible. They are like a couple of pages. And then they conclude, well, we cannot solve these equations. And that's the end of the paper. Okay? So let's look at these upgraded LT spacetimes in higher dimensions. So I can go to T dimensions, and now I'm computing the square between d_phi and dt. So there's a horizon, there's an ergosphere. You can play the same game. There will be a PG form. So if you set capital dt equal to 0, you will have a nice flat, d minus 1 dimensional metric around yourself, no matter where you are falling into the singularity. The horizon is manifestly regular. The spacetime has lots of explicit symmetries. It has, these killing vectors over here. But it's a great work of Finn, so applause to him. There is also lots of rank 2 killing tensors. So how the construction goes, so we can have up to m rotation parameters, ai. So m is the number of rotations you can have. And so now we take a subset of the power set of this S, okay? And so then we form a one form out of that. So many one forms characterized by, which subset you take. And so this is a crazy construction, which comes from the construction of Kerr ADS and their symmetries. So if you had Kerr ADS, the full Kerr ADS solution in all dimensions, then you would just take the I would go like, you would have sum over all rotations. So you have A1, mu1, d_phi1, and then plus A2, mu2, d_phi2, and so on. But here you only take a subset. It's like a relevant expansion to give an order in A. Anyway, so then again, this is the same construction as in Kerr ADS. You form a 2 form out of B. Let's call it H. You wedge these 2 forms. You take a hot star. You get something here. You square that something. And miraculously, you pull out of the hat a killing rank 2 killing tensor for this spacetime. Okay. And so then you take a different subset here of the power set, and you form another killing tensor. And then you form another killing tensor, and so on. Okay, so here they are explicitly what they are. But what is perhaps more interesting is how many of these are there, and how many of these are non-trivial, irreducible. And the statement is, there's basically m square of them. So m goes like the number of dimensions, d. So the number of these killing tensors goes like d square, right? So if you are in sufficiently high number of dimensions, then actually you suddenly start, your spacetime, which we have just seen, has more, these killing tensors than it has killing vectors. So it's the first example of a spacetime which has more hidden symmetries, more killing tensors than it has the explicit symmetry. Okay, so that's quite nice. So then you can start also taking these ascent brackets between the two.
For more than 4 dimensions?
Yeah.
A 4 dimension is just a same as this, just as one.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. So here I'm considering, you know, this generalization. So this will be really, really interesting in higher dimensions, mathematically at least, right? But if you are in four dimensions, you get only one. Yeah, so in four dimensions, but it's still interesting, right? You still I would say it's a simplest space-time is rank two Killing tensor. But if you go to higher dimensions, you know, there are these, you know, many more. So M is the number of rotation parameters. So and that goes like basically like D over two, where D is the number of space-time dimensions. So it's not precisely, but let's say, you know, in four dimensions, you have to subtract one. And then there's one rotation parameter. In five dimensions, you would have two. In six dimensions, still two. In seven, three, and so on. Right? So it's basically like D over two. M is like D over two. Okay, so now you can start taking the brackets of these Killing tensors, right? And, you know, most of the time you get zero, that's fine. But sometimes it happens that you don't get zero. And so what you have constructed here is a, let's say in six dimensions, you get nice reducible rank three Killing tensor. Then you take a bracket of rank three Killing tensor with rank two, one of these here, and you form a rank four Killing tensor, and so on. So it provides you a first example of a space-time in sufficient number of dimensions where you can generate, you know, high rank Killing tensors. And so what is not so clear at this point is whether, you know, the tower really, you know, terminates somewhere, or whether you keep generating higher and higher rank non-trivial Killing tensors. But anyway, this is like a first space-time which is physically motivated, which admits, you know, these higher rank Killing tensors. So we don't know what about the energy moment. Okay. Yeah. Because what you are really trying to construct here is a slowly rotating space-time. Right, so you're trying to.
Space-time is physically motivated.
Yeah, the space-time is physically motivated. So, for example, the construction which we had before, like lifting something two-dimensional to four dimensions, mm-hmm. You know, it's a nice mathematical construction, but there's no motivation, right? So, you know, for example, for care, right? So, if you have Carter's constant, it's something like, so you know that your space-time is no longer spherically symmetric. It is only axis symmetric. But you know, if you switch off the mass, then the Carter's constant becomes just angular momentum square, right? So basically, like it's an additional integral of motion which you get, which is something to do with the angular momentum, but it's not precisely that, because, you know, yeah. So it's hard to tell what is the physical meaning, but you know, the integral of motion is there. Okay, so more questions? Yes.
So I'm just trying to understand kind of what these objects mean. So when we talk about Killing vectors, those like pair with like one momentum, I guess, and that defines a constant motion on, say, a geodesic. And then talking about the Killing tensor. Two momenta, so we're talking like two trajectories or
a thing. No, it's still one trajectory. Still one trajectory. And it will be a constant of motion which is quadratic in the momentum of the particle. Right? But it's still a constant of motion for the particle. Something that particle, you know, you measure Carter's constant for the particle here, and then the particle evolves and moves somewhere, right? And you measure the Carter's constant there, and it's still the same. Right? So it's a constant of motion for the particle, which is however quadratic in the momenta, not linear in momenta.
Right. So then I guess a third order or third rank Killing tensor would be some sort of constant motion that's cubic momentum.
Exactly. Exactly.
So these correspond to symmetry on the phase space. If you project them down to the manifold, they won't correspond to an isometry. Whereas if you take a Killing vector, that's an isometry.
Okay. So the Killing vector corresponds to an isometry of your manifold, right? Your metric is invariant under that. These Killing tensors correspond to symmetries in your phase space, which depends on the particular trajectory you're looking at. So it depends on momentum and position.
So it's like a symmetry. Oh, the geodesic or of the space then?
Of the phase space, which is the trajectories plus the manifold.
Okay.
So basically what Finn is just saying right now here is that, well, I have a constant of motion, let's call it C, which is just PA xi A for a Killing vector, let's say, okay? So I have this constant over here. So now, because I am, you know, using the Hamiltonian fiction, whatever, I can construct for each constant, I can construct the corresponding vector field, which corresponds to the motion in the phase space, right? And so there will be xc, which is, well, a, which is something like omega a, b, and then db of c, okay? So that will be my vector field, which exists, or which flows in my phase space, if you want. Right, so then the question is, and so for given C, I can calculate what this thing here is. And so this thing here will have something over here, and then it will have coordinates. So it will have coordinates xA for the particle, that's the positions. And then it will have something else here, and then it will have dPA. Right? So this will be the components with respect to my x coordinates, and this will be the components of the vector field with respect to my momentum coordinates. Okay? So now what you do is that you are asking, well, what kind of symmetry I got? And that's done by a canonical projection of this vector field. So canonical projection, really what it does is that it projects from, you know, the fiber bundle to the configuration space, to the my manifold. So what it does, so now let's apply the canonical projection here on XC. And so what it really does is that it kills the p directions over here, okay? So it kills this part over here, and it just leaves the part on the configuration space, right? So now what happens over here is interesting. So the question is, let's call it, I don't know, xA here. So now the question is, does xA depends? It's not a coordinate. Let's call it something else. XCA, well, whatever. It's not a coordinate. Okay. So the question is this a function of coordinates on the configuration space only, or does it still depend on momenta? If it is a function of coordinates only, then this is like a vector field on my configuration space, and I can see it on my configuration space. It tells me I have a symmetry in the configuration space. If I move along this vector field there, you know, that represents my symmetry of the configuration space. Right. But if XCA depends on the momentum, then this is not well defined on the configuration space. I have no idea what the momentum is on the configuration space. And so then this will not be well defined on the configuration, and there won't be any symmetry of the configuration space. Okay, so then you can actually, you know, divide the symmetries either into isometries for which XCA is a nice vector on configuration space. Or this is not, and then these are called hidden symmetries. Hidden symmetries. And so in this case, XCA will depend on P and so on. So you know, this will be a screw up, and you don't know how to interpret these guys on the configuration space. So now if you have constants of motion which are linear in momentum, then you've precisely fall into this category. Right, where XCA will be actually your Killing vector on the configuration space. It will just be XIA. But if you have higher order, if you have Carter's constant, K, which is like the Killing tensor KAB, PA, PB, then you will find that this guy XCA will now depend on the momentum, because this thing here will kill only one momentum. And that's why this will be a hidden symmetry. It's not obvious on the configuration space. Okay, very good. So, more questions? Summary. Okay, so this lens rotating metric describes an approximate slowly rotating spacetime outside the rotating body or outside of the black hole. This is how it was found in 1918. And why it was very interesting already then is that, you know, it describes the frame dragging. So it really showed that GR is very, very different from Newton's theory. Suddenly, you don't have only electrostatics, but you have also electrodynamics, right? You have you know, the magnetic fields and so on. So very recently, that's been measured by Gravity Probe B, and you know that experiment took almost 50 years to complete. And you know this above, you know, form as I'm writing over here, is intrinsically linked to to the Neumann-Janisch algorithm. So this is precisely what is predicted at the linear order in A by the Neumann-Janisch algorithm. So what I have done here is that I tried to see whether, you know, this works also, you know, for some other beyond Einstein or Maxwell theories. And the answer is no. So at least in four dimensions, Einstein gravity is the only one which is the only gravitational theory where you can actually use the Neumann-Janisch formalism or where you can find slowly rotating solutions in this, you know, simple form of the metric.
The one with n times
n? The one with n equal to 1 and h equal to f minus 1. And similarly, you know, this can be generalized for space-time versus matter fields. And again, you know, for example, you cannot go to a generalization of Maxwell theory. So Maxwell theory, among all nonlinear electrodynamics, Maxwell theory is the only one for which this will work. Okay. However, in high dimensions, you can find some interesting examples where this works. And for example, charge ADS, slowly rotating one, works. Nobody knows how to do non-slowly rotating one. But it also works for, you know, these really, you know, high curvature gravities like Lovelock gravity and so on. So finally, I presented this, you know, new form of the metric where you complete the square between dt and d phi. And, you know, the nice thing about that is that, you know, this is manifested regular on the horizon. It makes this, you know, tower of rank 2 and high rank Killing tensors. The price to pay is that I still don't know what happens, you know, whether, you know, that metric with the completed square, whether that could be a solution of some, you know, like if you take as is, right, the metric as I have it, is it an exact solution of some something, right? And I don't know. So anyway, so this is my question. So for most of these, you know, higher curvature gravities and so on, can we find full solutions, not just the slowly rotating ones? So for GR, it took from 1918 of Lenzi and Thiering to Kerr, 1963, 50 years, right? So can we find some full solutions of these interesting theories in less than 50 years? So let me stop here.
I was trying to get something in less than 50 years. I gave it like a week and then quit. I was trying to basically go from the spherically symmetric solutions we have in, for example, particle cubic gravity or dealing like the one above. You know, there it's very easy to find EFT solutions in the sense that there are solutions symmetric to a certain order in the coupling parameter taking a separate duration, right? So then you can find those solutions. And then I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go do Neumann-Janisch now and get the rotating solution, and of course it doesn't work. So, but of course I gave it a week. You know? Because the thing is, like, would you expect, because here you didn't have this requirement of saying, okay, the solutions that I have to have, their full solution is not perturbative in the sense of the coupling parameter being perturbative and the solution being expansion. Do you think there could be room for improvement there?
Yeah, I don't know. and this was in four dimensions or in high in four dimensions? Yeah. Yeah, I think in four dimensions it's pretty tight, right?
Yeah. Especially the form wasn't like the form of the solutions is not like n times f. It's more like f than g, where.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing, right? So, let's see. Where is the metric? At the very beginning, right?
That was one.
That was one?
Yeah. One more.
Five more. Oh, there we go. Yeah, yeah. So this is the answer, right? So basically what you are assuming here is that, well, this would be your spherically symmetric static solution, right? You would have NF and so you have two metric functions characterizing your static solution, which is the most you can have, and then you are just assuming that, you know, everything is captured here by an extra metric function over here, dt d phi, which is also reasonable, mm-hmm. right? You would, yeah. So that's the most general thing, but yeah.
So you're assuming that you're necessarily symmetric solution goes like n times 1 over f. Is that an assumption?
So
there are two functions and you say that you can factorize them one as n times.
Okay, very good.
That's not true in the symmetric solution, that's outside.
So very good. So we haven't checked like what happens if you know if you keep f, if you keep non-trivial n, right? But that's not a property of rotation. It's really a property of like spherically symmetric solution, right? So having n or not having it, it's a property of static solution. So and so then you know the theories which have n equal to one are nice theories, right? Those which don't have n equal to one are not so nice, right? And so I think there was a paper by Canos. That they show that you know if you don't have n equal to one that it, something is screwed up with the theory. there was a recent paper. I would have to find it. I'll have to find it.
Well, I mean, if you have a star, then it's not bounds, right? So.
That's right. Yeah. No. That well, but then you have matter, right? Then you have matter, and matter can violate these things.
But the other thing I was going to say that it seems that the most general first order metric you could have, I mean, could be just like this, but instead of sinus square theta, you could have some function of sinus square theta. Because I mean, if you want to have something as leading order in A, a collinear in A, you don't want it to appear anywhere else except there, because I mean, it should be, everywhere else it would be quadratic, I think, and it's only there, but then the theta dependent. Be anything. I don't think it has to be. So maybe the more general, and that would be the sum function of sine squared instead of the sine squared.
Yeah, I would have to think about that. Certainly, you know, if you start including things like cosine theta and stuff like that, you are sort of drifting towards top nut solution and stuff like that. But maybe you could consider something more general there. That's true. Okay, let me think about that.
Yeah. Or maybe the R and theta not
You're saying to leading order, it cannot appear at all. You cannot appear anywhere else except there. Any more questions? Well, I guess we have enough.
Thank you so much.